Today in Studio 360, I talk with William Shatner.
Calling home.
The former Captain Kirk has a new book and a new record, and he never stops performing. Did I mention he's 80?
You arrive at where you are by the points that you've said yes to, and the dots of your life are connected.
Second stage is cut. We're now in orbit. Stabilizers up.
And Roland Emmerich, the director behind movies like Independence Day and Godzilla, has a new one about whether William Shakespeare was really William Shakespeare.
We all know William Shakespeare, the most famous author of all time. But what if I told you Shakespeare never wrote a single word?
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, I'll talk with William Shatner. More than four decades after first playing Captain Kirk, he's still serious about outer space.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
And the 26-year-old Taya Obrett, her first novel, The Tiger's Wife, just got nominated for this year's National Book Award. But to start things off, last weekend, Amazon flew a few dozen authors and other creative types out to Santa Fe for its second annual campfire gathering. I couldn't make it, but I did attend the first one last year. One day, over lunch, just me and an Amazon executive, I asked if this was part of the softening up process of authors for their master plan to take over the book industry. He just chuckled. Well, suddenly, Amazon, the world's largest book retailer, has become a serious publisher as well. They've recently put together a top-notch team of editors and are releasing 122 titles this fall. The old publishers were already freaked out by the power of their giant frenemy, Amazon. Now they're freaking out some more.
They even opened up an outpost in New York City, so they're actually trying to move in on publishers' own territory.
Jason Bogue is the editor of Galley Cat, which covers the book business. This is a shift in the industry that could affect everybody who writes and reads books.
Absolutely. There's two forces going on here. We're watching the publishing industry contract because digital books just don't bring in the same margins of profits that you would see with a hardcover. And at the same time, hardcover and paperback sales are decreasing. So it's a perfect opportunity for Amazon to start doing this distribution. And as they tap into these millions of people that want to self-publish, they're going to have a tremendous distribution channel.
But I wonder if, I mean, they were already, the book publishing industry was already worried and the sky has been falling for a while. This is just one more thing. Are they overreacting?
Yeah. To put this in context, I actually like to go back to the 1930s of all times. I'm writing a book right now called Will Write for Change, looking at how writers survived the Great Depression. And during the Great Depression, department stores almost drove the publishing business out of business by using books as loss leaders. They would do the same strategy Amazon did. They would mark down new books to very cheap prices just to get people into stores and buying things. They were also worried about these new publishing technologies. The paperback book was just being introduced. Some people were scoffing at it, saying, you'll never sell a million copies of a paperbound book. And other people were starting to build empires. And so it's kind of a roadmap almost of how you can get through an economic crisis.
I wonder if there's any subtler ways in which now that Amazon will be seriously in the publishing of books business, that they will understand the publisher's business better and what they do and how it's done. Well, I wonder if down the line there could be some unanticipated benefits to that.
My secret theory is that Amazon, while they're paying giant advances right now, I think the ultimate effect of having Amazon in there is we're going to see a smarter publishing industry. We're not going to just print 100,000 copies of a book and then see what happens. I think it's going to be very conservative the way Amazon enters this market. And I think ultimately they're going to be paying smaller advances and publishing smarter print runs, things like that.
At least in the meantime, with all this ferocious new competition, it seems to me for we readers, and speaking selfishly for myself as an author, it's not necessarily bad for us.
Oh, no. I think the person we could talk to about that is Penny Marshall, the great actor and director. She just sold her memoir to Amazon for $800,000, according to the New York Times, which is some serious money. John Locke, self-published thriller writer through Amazon. He was the first self-published writer to sell 1 million digital books on Amazon's Kindle platform. It was a big milestone.
Well, and the thing is, even though there's nervousness about encroaching on territory and all that, they totally and completely need each other for their respective businesses.
Oh, absolutely. Amazon will never, ever be able to replace the publishing industry. They'll never, some people worry about them controlling everything, but it's not true. The big six publishers are not going to go away. They're going to be smaller, and they're going to have this new seventh star sitting beside them, but it's not going to go away.
Although, when I talk to people in publishing, they often say, yes, they want us to keep us alive, but just barely alive. That's the great fearful scenario.
I think we're going to see, like I said, a much smaller publishing industry. I think the big six publishers are going to be making a lot less books. They're going to cut down the production. They'll be focusing on celebrity memoirs and the books that are the surefire bestsellers. There's going to be a lot less risks taken. And we're going to see surrounding them these little islands of publishers, independent presses that will take the rest of the writers, all of the, we call them the mid-list writers. And then you're going to see Amazon, I think, sitting right alongside the big six publishers with a very sizable, influential place. But the publishing is going to survive. And whether you look at the Great Depression or now, it's going to survive. It's just going to be a rough 5 years here.
Jason Bogue, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Jason Bogue is the editor of Galley Cat, online at Media Bistro. So do you care who publishes the books you buy? Is Amazon good for books and literature or not? Tell us at studio360.org. Taya Abret's first novel, The Tiger's Wife, came out earlier this year. And the praise has been extreme and pretty universal for its writerly skill as it shifts between realism and fairy tale-ish fable, and for its sense of deep wisdom about memory, faith, family, and death. And then there's the astonishing fact of Taya Abret's age. She just turned 26. Last summer, she won the British Orange Prize, given annually to the best English-language novel by a woman, and now The Tiger's Wife is one of five works of fiction nominated for this year's National Book Award. Taya Abret, you young person, you, welcome to Studio 360, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So there are several distinct stories going on in The Tiger's Wife. When somebody you meet on an airplane, let's say, asks you, well, so what's your novel about? What do you say?
Well, I say that it's a novel that takes place in an unnamed province of the former Yugoslavia, which is where I'm from, and that it follows a young doctor named Natalia who is coming to terms with the circumstances of her grandfather's death, which are pretty mysterious, and involve her reflecting on stories that he told her about his childhood and about his time as a doctor when he met this vagabond named the Deathless Man.
At what age did you begin writing fiction?
I started writing when I was 8. I wrote my first short story, I was just sort of getting used to the English language. And I liked the way the word goat looked. It was a very attractive word for me. I thought that it had depth and many different kinds of letters. And so I wrote a short story about a goat. And we were living in Cyprus at the time, and my mother had this ancient laptop computer, and you sort of had to drum down on the keys with your fists. And I wrote the story, and I took it to my mother and said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to write.
And she said, sure.
That's great. Yeah. She was like, sure. All right. Yeah. And that sort of became the path.
And is it true, as I've read, that one of the ways you learned English was watching VHS cassettes of old Disney movies?
Yeah, I learned English off of, you know, bootleg Disney movies, and I knew the dialogue, you know, from beginning to end. But I had no idea what the characters were saying, so I would go around like a parrot, you know, walk around the house and repeat the lines of dialogue, which my mother found extraordinarily annoying.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we think of, oh, the great mythic storytelling tradition of the Balkans and Eastern Europe and Egypt, but, you know, it sounds as though perhaps the Walt Disney Corporation's version of myth and fable might have been one of your the influences that you drew on.
I think that it certainly is. I mean, I liked fairy tales as a child, and they were pretty good at adapting fairy tales. I do think, however, that there is such a thing as a Disney-fied fairy tale.
For sure.
And I think that I was always drawn, and I don't know what this says about me, but I was always drawn to the real fairy tale,
right.
You know, to the grim version of
the violent, sad, grim ones, yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, you don't exactly see, you know, in Snow White, you don't see the queen strapped into iron shoes and then forced to, you know, walk until she kills her, you know, until she walks herself to death. And I always, you know, thought that kind of macabre thing was fascinating. Like, how could people come up with this?
Yeah.
It's so awful. And I found it sort of richer and more complex, and it said more about people. And so I was more drawn to that version of the story almost always.
As you're writing this book, which veers and almost seamlessly shifts back and forth between these fable-like mythic environments and events and fairly straightforward realism, is it tricky? Do you require a different kind of writerly trance to do those two kinds of writing?
I think so. I was never... That must be the case, because I was never able to switch from one section of the book to another in a single writing period.
Huh.
If I was writing a tiger section, I could continue with other tiger sections. You know, I could skip to a different section with the tiger and his wife. I could skip to a deathless man section, but I would not be able to skip back to one of Natalia's sections.
Right.
And Natalia's sections were written almost all of them rewritten entirely after the book had already been through one round of edits, because I happened to go vampire hunting in Serbia and Croatia for a nonfiction piece that I did for Harper's.
Right.
And inadvertently did a whole bunch of research that I didn't realize I needed, but that enriched the book tremendously.
So wait a sec. Vampire hunting. Harper's Magazine sends you to the land of your birth and the land of vampires, yes, to do an article about the folklore surrounding them. When you show up there, do you feel like it's a homecoming, or are you just this American outsider doing an article?
I did feel like an outsider, but not because I was an American. And you know, the communication part aspect was not a barrier. It was getting people to admit to something, because people were very shy about their superstitions, and they were aware that this would be perceived as a superstition,
right,
and could potentially be a minefield of mockery.
Right.
The thing that people were most concerned about when we spoke to them about vampires and superstitions and beliefs was for us to understand that during Tito's time, during Tito's regime, none of these beliefs existed. And that was because people were stable and happy and didn't have a need for ridiculous notions of vampirism and superstitions. And several people told us this, most of them, you know, between the ages of 70 and 95. And it was very interesting. It was something that...
That's fascinating. Because one, of course, as, you know, in the 90s, one thought and then read that, of course, Tito kept, by being an atheist communist, kept a lid on all of these roiling religious tensions. But I never thought that he also kept a lid on the other half of the mythic superstition pot, you know, about vampires and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, apparently, because, I mean, that has to do with the fact that I think religion, Christian, Judeo-Christian Muslim religion in its, you know, in its sort of blanket terms the way we see it today, that is predated by these deep pagan roots that persist from Croatia to Serbia to Bosnia to Slovenia to Montenegro, everywhere,
right.
Because they're very much the same. You know, you get rid of a vampire in Serbia the same way you get rid of a vampire in Croatia. And they may be different words, but it's the same thing. And that was a very fascinating thing to learn and very heartening in a way.
Yeah. So for the last few months, you have been and are the sort of it girl of literature. It's true. You can laugh, but it's true. Is that completely gratifying? Or is there any downside at all, or is it just as wonderful and Cinderella-like as one might imagine?
The fact that the book exists and that people have read it is Cinderella-like. Because of my own personal nature, which is to doubt everything and fear everything, and, you know, immediately after a good thing happens, like, you know, in Balkan culture, it's you find $5 on the floor, and the next thing you pick them up, and right. The next thing you know, you are getting run over by a train,
right.
And because that is how the world works karmically. So I have some trepidations about...
Right.
Having this book afford me the life that I wanted. I mean, I wanted to be able to write, and now I get to write a second book, and that's ridiculous to me. And I, you know, somewhere deep in my core, I believe that that's going to come with some form of payment, and I
right.
really, really would rather not know what that is.
I think you have at least a couple of complete duds before they'll take away the chance. Yeah, but thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kurt.
The Tiger's Wife was just nominated for a National Book Award. You can hear my interviews with some of this year's other National Book Award nominees, including Stephen Greenblatt, author of The Swerve, How the World Became Modern, and the late Manning Marrable on his biography of Malcolm X. That's at Studio360.org. Coming up...
Is this the real life?
The actor, writer, and recording artist, William Shatner.
Caught in a landslide. No escape from reality. Open your eyes. Look up to the skies. And see.
That's ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
'Cause I'm easy come. Easy go, little high, little low, any way the wind blows, doesn't really matter to me.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The movie Anonymous, directed by Roland Emmerich, opens this week. And except for the heavy use of computer-generated images, it is nothing like his previous disaster-ramas. 2012, The Day After Tomorrow, Independence Day. But that's not why Anonymous will be controversial. The ads show the silhouette of an Elizabethan man holding a quill pen with the tagline, "Was Shakespeare a fraud?" As long as there have been professional Shakespeare scholars, there's also been a minority of fervent Shakespeare skeptics. Mark Twain, Sigmund Freud, Orson Welles, and others all thought that William Shakespeare had a ghostwriter. Studio 360's Mark Anderson, no relation, wades deep into the "Was Shakespeare Shakespeare?" debate.
True confessions time. I am a heretic. I don't think William Shakespeare, the actor from Stratford-upon-Avon, wrote all those plays and poems. That sounds nuts, I know. But back in 1993, I heard some scholars argue that Edward de Vere, an Elizabethan court playwright, wrote Shakespeare's work. The more I read about de Vere, the more it made sense. Ultimately, I even wrote a book. And now, there's this new movie that's going to change things.
None of your plays will ever carry your name. None.
We have created this reimagining of the Elizabethan era.
This is John Orloff, the screenwriter of Anonymous.
And what I try to say to people is the first thing you have to remember is it's closer to North Korea right now than America right now.
Right.
That Elizabethan England was this incredibly totalitarian state. It was a feudal society run by a dictator without free speech, without any of the things we think they might have had.
Orloff's point is that Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, could write better plays if his name wasn't on them. For heretics like me, we're called Oxfordians. Anonymous is a golden opportunity. It comes at a price, though. For the first time ever, millions of people will be paying attention to the controversy. Great. But Anonymous is rip-roaring entertainment, not a historical argument. Queen Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen, has children who run around staging rebellions. Will Shakespeare kills another playwright. These things didn't happen, and Oxfordians will take some knocks as a result. On the other hand, we're used to it.
When you are questioned by people, I don't always have the answers. The one that always stumps me is why.
This is Derek Jacobi. He's done King Lear, Hamlet, Richard III, The Tempest, and on and on. Jacobi is an outspoken Oxfordian, too.
Why would he hide? Yeah. You can come up with a number of reasons. And who would have known why? Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, which is a big put down. But I find it difficult to answer.
To me, I just give a three-word answer, sex and politics.
Sex and politics. Yes. Why? Sex and politics.
Yes. Yes.
In the smallest nutshell I can find, here's the case for Edward de Vere and against Will Shakespeare. Start with the paper trail. Will Shakespeare led a well-documented life as an actor and businessman, but the biggest literary manhunt in history has turned up essentially nothing suggesting he was a writer. No manuscripts, no letters, no records of anyone paying him to write anything. He didn't own any books, which is really weird. When you read popular biographies of Shakespeare as an author, what you're reading is conjecture. In the words of Mark Twain, Shakespeare is a brontosaur, 9 bones and 600 barrels of plaster of Paris. By contrast, Edward de Vere's epic life story practically haunts the Shakespeare canon. I can name hundreds of ways that his biography corresponds to the Shakespeare plays.
If I could just get a word in,
of course.
That's Alan Nelson, professor emeritus of English at the University of California, Berkeley.
The Shakespeare profession is virtually unanimous in accepting William Shakespeare of Stratford as the author. And it's really a romantic and a post-romantic idea that authors put themselves, their own autobiographies, into their tales, or in this case, plays.
For starters, I asked Nelson about a new book called Shakespeare's Guide to Italy. It's filled with examples of how Shakespeare's depictions of Italy are note perfect, but Will Shakespeare never left England.
The reason for that is everybody likes to have Shakespeare be their own.
Well, but my point is...
I recently got an email from a woman who thinks that Shakespeare must have been Jewish because he understands the Jewish customs so well. Doctors like to think he was a doctor. Lawyers like to think he was a lawyer. People who live in Italy like to think he was Italian. Fair enough. This is just, again, wish fulfillment. All you have to do is pick and choose and you will have your wish fulfilled.
Nelson and I have been arguing about Edward de Vere for years. We both wrote biographies of the man.
There's one point, it seems to me, in which there is a real lack of overlap that I'd like to bring up, and that is Edward de Vere had his own playing company, founded in 1580, and it existed until 1602. So this is my question. If the Earl of Oxford had his own company called Oxford's Men during all of this period, why would he have given his plays to a rival company?
It's a good question, and I don't have a good answer. Except to note that Will Shakespeare's company was much more successful than de Vere's, and de Vere was always broke. Here's an example. By the age of 40, de Vere was financially ruined. He had 3 daughters by his first marriage, and he had to disperse his ancestral castle amongst them. Change castle for kingdom, and you have the setup for King Lear.
Know that we have divided in 3 our kingdom. And 'tis our fast intent to shake all cares and business from our age, conferring them on younger strengths, while we unburdened crawl towards death.
When De Vere was returning from Italy, he ran into a foreign nobleman who was leading an army on the march. The leader staged an impromptu parade of his troops before De Vere's eyes. Then De Vere boarded a ship for England, and the ship was overtaken by pirates. This exact same sequence of events happens in Hamlet.
On all occasions to inform against me and spur my dull revenge. What is a man if his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed? A beast, no more. Sure, he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability, and godlike reason to fust in us unused.
De Vere's sister was a raging fireball who met her match in a swashbuckler who wooed and wed her. That's the Taming of the Shrew.
Come on and kiss me, Kate.
Do you want me to go on for the next 2 hours? Yeah, me neither.
If the plays contain the life of Edward de Vere, nobody noticed that until 1920. And therefore, everybody who interpreted the plays missed this main point, which to me is an irrelevant point.
So you're saying, in Patsy Cline's words, how could we be so wrong for so long?
Yes.
Okay. Score one for Nelson.
For me, the problem with Edward de Vere is that he was never capable of seeing anything from any other person's point of view from his own. And a great dramatic playwright has to be the opposite of that. He has to see things from the point of view of every character, including the minor characters.
The Earl of Oxford was often a jerk. No argument there. He made life hell for people around him. But do we really think the greatest author in the English language also has to be nice?
Oxford's an ass. I tend to find most artists are, actually.
That's John Orloff again, the screenwriter of this new movie, Anonymous.
I don't know a filmmaker or screenwriter who is not self-obsessed. And I don't mean that necessarily in a negative way. I mean, because at the end of the day, what you really are saying is, I know the world better than you do. I know it enough that I can share it with the rest of the world. And that is a very, very egotistical thing to say.
And Roland Emmerich himself, the director? I met him after a screening of Anonymous. He blames the court of public opinion for holding back the truth.
I didn't understand when I was making the movie and decided to make the movie how powerful the literary establishment really is. So it's very, very hard to jump over your shadow and say, you know, your like teacher didn't told you the truth. That is a very, very big departure for anybody in life. I always like to compare it a little bit. I'm gay, so it was a very hard thing for me to come out.
Right.
What? It's just like this inner thing. You know you're right. You know you're like, can I have a right to be gay? But do you really want to say it?
In other words, Emmerich suspects there may be many more Oxfordians out there, hiding in the closet, so to speak, than we think. I really don't know if he's right. All I can say is, if he is, this drama is going to get pretty interesting pretty fast. For Studio 360, I'm Mark Anderson.
Mark Anderson is the author of Shakespeare by Another Name. A new ebook edition is out this month. And the movie Anonymous opens this week.
Space, a final frontier.
It was 40-odd years ago that William Shatner played Captain Kirk on Star Trek on television.
To boldly go where no man has gone before.
But it was Star Trek's afterlife in reruns during the 70s that turned Shatner into a cult figure. Today, a whole new cohort of fans who never knew him as Kirk know him as Denny Crane, the blustery, ridiculous senior partner on Boston Legal.
I'm afraid the circumstances of this meeting are not pleasant. We're letting you go.
What? Why?
Well, it's not that your performance hasn't been good. I'm told you do fine work. But since partnership is not in your future, we prefer to let those associates go rather than mislead them. It's only fair.
Would you mind telling me why partnership's not in my future?
Not at all. You're fat.
Excuse me?
We can't have fat people working at Crane, Poole, and Schmidt. That's all. And seriously, thank you for your past work. I mean that.
This month, William Shatner has both a new book and a new album out. I asked him how he's doing more at 80 than most people do at any age.
As I state in the book, on my 40th birthday, I went to bed for 3 days. I was totally depressed. What had I done with my life? Where was I going? Well, when you're 80 and you wake up.
And that was a shock to you, your system as well.
Well, absolutely. Even more so because now 80 is like you've reached the fence. This is the end.
You can certainly see the fence.
You're sitting on it. And that will make you think.
There was a GQ profile of you, GQ magazine, in which last year, in which the writer hypothesizes that your character, your wonderful character on Boston Legal, Denny Crane, was, quote, a point-on mockery of William Shatner's career and symbology, and that you, by fully embracing the notion that William Shatner should not be taken seriously, he is at last taken seriously as an actor and wins 2 Emmys. Do you buy that?
I don't even know what that means.
It means that this character was ridiculous and pompous as part of your lampoon public persona is, and you went with it and people saw, wow, he's fantastic as an actor.
Well, that may be true because an actor brings his own persona to every role he tries so that the young, in my case, Shatner, is not the same as the older Shatner, but it is essentially the same. There is the same characteristics that can't be obviated.
And seems to connect in some way more or less with who one is as a real human being.
That's exactly right. You can't change your basic nature. An actor, as much as he tries to assume a character, is basically himself. And so what I bring to a role is me. And you exaggerate those parts of you. And maybe he was right.
You have, as well as this new book, a new record album called Seeking Major Tom. It features the kinds of spoken word songs, covers of songs that you've been recording for a long time. And in fact, it reminded me that when I was 13, I bought a copy of your LP, The Transformed Man.
Really?
When it was brand new.
Yeah.
And who knows how much money I had to spend on records as a kid, but I did. And I just want to remind people of my age and for young listeners who perhaps haven't heard it, play one of the cuts off that album from 1968.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
That was Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds by William Shatner, put out just after the Beatles had done it and at the high moment of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds-ness.
Right.
You were serious. It was entirely a serious venture?
Absolutely, because it was linked with a piece of literature. I think that was Cyrano, which Cyrano says at the end, I may climb to no great heights, but I will climb alone. And then that was put to music, and then music segues into Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. So this guy is a LSD. He's on an LSD trip. All the words indicate that. So I was contrasting a man who could stand alone with a man who couldn't.
So you're doing a collage of literature and music.
Exactly. And it begat this latest record, of which I'm enormously proud of, and I hope it goes well.
Let's listen to the opening track.
Standing there alone, the ship is waiting. All systems are go.
Are you sure?
Control is not convinced, but the computer has the evidence. No need to abort. The countdown starts. Watching in a trance, the crew is certain. Nothing left to chance. All is working, trying to relax. Up in the capsule, send me up a drink. Jokes Major Tom. The count goes on. Earth below us, drifting
falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
That is William Shatner, quote unquote, singing Space Oddity off his new record, Seeking Major Tom.
And Space Oddity has Major Tom stepping out of the capsule and disappearing. We don't know what happened to him. The next 19 songs are my concept of what happened to Major Tom. And they're all cover songs of great numbers that were alive, so that he was walking on the moon. He thinks of his wife in Rocket Man. His wife blinded him with science. He's a space cowboy. He learned to learning to fly.
So it's pop music of the last 40 years.
All
again,
put together in a space opera, if you will,
yeah.
Of where to Major, what happened to Major Tom, using the sounds of Houston and the control tower. Where are you, Major Tom? Where are you? And eventually the rocket breaks up using the sounds of the Voyager.
Right. It's interesting that David Bowie invented that character just about the time you were finishing up your life as Captain Kirk. I mean, that it's a funny other end of the 40-year period.
Well, we know that NASA was flying those, and the moonshot came about at that time. So I guess that was it.
After the original Star Trek series ended, you initially steered clear of the conventions and fan life and afterlife, and you write about that in the book. Then you embraced it, and as recently as a few years ago, you were voicing Star Trek video games, and now there's this space-themed record. It's interesting to me, again, reading the book, you seem to have, on the one hand, embraced, but still feeling somewhat ambivalent about this Beam Me Up, Scotty stuff again.
Well, yeah. I've directed a documentary called The Captains. Really interesting documentary I got to make by examining the actors who played Star Trek, played the captains.
In all the movies and all the TV shows.
All six captains. What unified them? What disparate things about them?
And you directed and made this
I produced and directed this this film that involved me because I was one of the captains. Whereupon I had an epiphany in the films, part of the documentary, when doing research on Patrick Stewart. He was saying how important and how seriously he took the role of Captain Picard. And I realized in that moment that in the last many years, I've been sort of holding my hands up in defense of what I perceive to be perhaps derision of, hey, beam me up, Scotty. Well, what do they mean? What are they doing? I thought it was pretty good, but maybe they're laughing at it. I better go along with it, sort of in my psyche. And then it was part of me, and I sort of that was my response. Beam me up, Scotty. Hey. Get off me.
Yeah.
What I learned and what I realized in the documentary is, hey, it's a compliment, and I should answer them as such. So I should say I would if I could.
And Patrick Stewart isn't derided for taking it seriously.
No.
And he plays Shakespeare at BAM.
Exactly.
And so you own it again as a result of this epiphany.
Exactly. That's exactly what part of the Captains contains.
I just finished writing a novel in which the main character as a kid, a girl in the 60s, is forced by her parents to learn Esperanto. And in fact, I have a scene in the book where she and her family arrange a screening of the movie Incubus in 1966.
In your novel?
Yes.
That's hysterical.
Starring William Shatner.
Oh, my God.
And I just want to play a clip from Incubus, which, because it's in Esperanto, some of our listeners may have trouble understanding.
Some.
Chester, don't you? Me minus Chester Valley. Gaturi Chiak von Havas Kuritz Pavon.
The aspecto estas mi bona.
Fresh pure air or a vivigus min.
Si, I oculo estas clara.
Dum la lastai tre noctai mi est ebri dormi. Sans audi tondron.
That's William Shatner as the star of Incubus.
I haven't heard that in all the years since then. It sounds pretty darn good if you knew what it – but what I felt, I have convinced all the people who spoke and speak Esperanto that that's the right way to pronounce the word.
And it was criticized at the time by Esperanto speakers I discovered.
Right. But they did. They don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Who's
speaking,
the correct Esperanto
exactly.
speaker?
I'm speaking from a position of authority from
there
the silver screen. How could I be wrong?
How much is that, the fact that you are so eager to learn and do, made your affect seem not like an 80-year-old man, not like a 70-year-old man, maybe a 60-year-old man.
You've got to be interested in something. You've got to have a passion for something, whether it's for keeping the front of your shirt clean if you're 80 and dribbling. I mean, I don't care what it is, but you've got to
care.
You've got to care. Exactly. You've got to care about the squirrel that is your love life, or the gray-haired old lady who's nodding off beside you. Whatever it is, care, and that will keep you alive.
Well said. Bill Shatner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The book Shatner's Rules and the album Seeking Major Tom are both out right now.
Into the distance, a ribbon of black, stretched to the point of no turning back. A flight of fancy on a windswept field, standing alone. My senses reel.
Coming up, when an MIT student decided to get a tattoo, picking the design was a no-brainer.
If I turn my arm over on the other side, there's a heart. So really, what my whole tattoo says is, if Cantor theorem, then heart. Love of logic is like a necessary truth for me.
That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we've got a special event coming up. On Wednesday night, November 9th, we're recording the show with an audience in New York City. My guests will be the funny and brilliant novelist Colson Whitehead, the funny and brilliant cultural critic Central Wilson, and the funny and brilliant comedian and musician Tim Minchin.
We go together like a bird in a nest, like internet and kiddie porn, like guns in the U.S. And if you love me like you say you do, you'd purchase 40 cockatoo and teach them.
That's Wednesday, November 9th at WNYC's Jerome L. Green Performance Space. You can get tickets at studio360.org, and I hope to see you there. A few years ago, the science writer Carl Zimmer was at a pool party and noticed that one of his friends had a tattoo of DNA on his back. You know, the two spiraling strands that make up a double helix. The friend was a neurobiologist, and Zimmer blogged about it. He runs a popular science blog called The Loon. Before he knew it, dozens of scientists and mathematicians were sending him photos and stories about their tattoos. And Carl Zimmer has just put them into a new book called Science Inc. That's I-N-K. Studio 360's Lou Olkowski spoke with a couple of the people in the book, including that guy from the pool party, whose name, I swear, is Bob Data.
The sort of person who gets a tattoo is the sort of person who never responds to a statement, TMI. Right? Tattoo people don't believe in too much information.
So you're an open book?
Yeah. Yes. And that's actually not uncommon among scientists. Science, by definition, only works in the open. You share your results so others can look at them carefully, scrutinize them, criticize them, replicate them. And science moves forward through that process of sharing.
Bob Data's work at Harvard Medical School depends on the ability to manipulate DNA, cutting it into pieces, gluing it back together, putting it into different organisms like mice, and watching its effects. DNA encodes everything, including blueprints for how the brain works. Bob's specialty. Back in 2002, Bob really wanted to get a tattoo, and he thought a DNA double helix would be perfect, a symbol of his work and himself, really. Eliza, his girlfriend at the time, wasn't so sure.
I got the arched eyebrow.
This was going to take some work. So Bob told Eliza he'd encode her initials into the tattoo. That he could do easily. The code for the protein glutamate is E, and Eliza's initials are EEE. Depending on how you read Bob's tattoo, it says Eliza Emond Edelberg or glutamate, 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 which is very romantic to a neurobiologist. And romantic enough for Eliza.
We went to this tattoo parlor in the Chelsea Hotel, which I assure you was as authentic as one would want. And we both kind of stopped short up front and asked ourselves momentarily whether we really wanted to go through with this because it seemed really dark and potentially really painful.
But it was an engagement gift. He held Eliza's hand, gritted his teeth, and the tattoo artist went to work.
He put some Thrasher music on cassette tape into his Ghetto Blaster, and he turned the volume up to 10. And then he says, "Are you ready?" And I said, "I'm ready." And then he revved up this tattoo gun and goes, and then he hits play, and it's like.
Can you strip down and show me your tattoo?
Sure. I can try. Would you like? I'm a relatively new professor. It's taken me a while to get used to the rules, but I think one of the rules is you don't sit shirtless in your office.
The odd thing about Bob's tattoo of devotion to his work and his wife is that it's tattooed on his back, where no one can see it. He can't even see it.
I guess that's true, right? I wonder why I did that.
Do you guys spoon?
As often as we can.
Now, is she ever the big spoon?
She's often the big spoon, I think.
Really? So when you guys spoon, potentially she can look right at it.
Yeah, exactly. I think she does.
Like Bob said, tattoo people don't believe in too much information. Another tattoo from Carl Zimmer's book looks like rows of ancient hieroglyphics wrapped around someone's left arm. It belongs to a third-year grad student at MIT named Melissa Schumacher. Her tattoo comes from love of another kind, a love that began in grade school.
I would just, like, pretend to be taking notes, but actually I would just be doing long division. And so, like, where other kids are, like, doodling, I would be, like, dividing things. I would, like, fill up entire pages with this stuff. It's like a compulsion.
She got her love of logic and math from her dad.
He had lots of math books lying around.
One of her favorites was called 1-2-3 Infinity. She first read it when she was 7 or 8 years old.
I didn't get all the way through it the first time, so by the time I finished it, I was probably like 12.
It was her first introduction to Cantor's theorem, which is now tattooed on her arm using Frege's notation, one of the original codes for writing logic. Her friends know what Frege's notation is, but even at MIT, no one has ever been able to decipher it.
So what Cantor's theorem says is, you give me a set.
A group of numbers.
Any set you like, and I can give you a bigger set than that. And it works even if you give me an infinite set. So you give me just, you think you can, like, trick me, and you give me all the numbers. Like, aha, you can't make a bigger set than that because there are infinitely many. But I can still give you a bigger set. So it's also infinite, but it's like a bigger infinity, or maybe a denser infinity is like an easier way to imagine it.
The next time she saw Cantor's theorem, she was studying electrical engineering and philosophy at MIT. It blew her mind all over again.
And it's just so clear, and it was really impressive. It like made me want to cry. I'm like almost crying right now thinking about it. If I can spend my life thinking about stuff like this, why would I want to do anything else?
When she looks down at her arm, she sees two lines of symbols.
And so if I turn my arm over, on the other side, there's a heart. So really, what my whole tattoo says is, if Cantor's theorem, then heart. It's a mathematical truth. Love of logic is like a necessary truth for me.
When you really believe in what you do, that becomes a part of you.
And if you get it punched into your skin and ink, it really is a part of you. For Studio 360, I'm Lou Olkowski.
And it looks like you shave your back.
I confess for this photograph I did, but I don't routinely. I'm a hairy Indian guy. There's just no way around that. I talked to Eliza and I was like, would I do some manscaping for Carl? I've been friends with Carl for 20 years. If he asked me, would I shave my back once? The answer is yes. I did, yeah.
You can see Bob's and Melissa's tattoos, along with lots of other designs from Carl Zimmer's book, Science Inc., at studio360.org. Have you got a tattoo related to your profession? If so, post a photo at studio360.org and tell us about it. That is it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen to our next one. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Emma Miller,
Katie Long,
Sharon Mashihi.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiekum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the great visionary of our era.
2010 turned out to be the year of the iPad.
The late Steve Jobs.
The only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do.
The brand new biography of Steve Jobs. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.